So thanks very much to the organizers for the opportunity to talk today. Mostly today what I'm going to tell you about are our attempts to measure the mechanics and the structure of the cell coat, which I'll define in a moment, and sort of our ideas about why it matters for cell function and where we're going ultimately with these measurements. Okay? So the paracellular coat is also called the glycocalyx in some different groups of people, or the paracellular matrix. And it's something which is normally neglected, or at least from my point of view in most of the biophysics community. And I was really astounded when I realized that quite a few different cells that many of us work with can have a thick polymer matrix on the surface of the cell, okay? And so what we're looking at here is a very odd picture. You may see that there's two cells here attached to the surface, and surrounding it, there's a lot of sort of blobs. That's not very physical. What's around it are actually fixed red blood cells, which have been added to demonstrate the fact that you can't reach the cell surface because there's a goo in between the surface and those blood cells. Okay? That's basically what's called the paracellular coat, and this has been the technology for the last 40 years to look at the paracellular coat, to add literally red blood cells and see how it affects things. And aside from this technique, there's been very few ways to visualize it, to measure it, and so forth, primarily because most of the ways that biologists would go about labeling it or approaching it would either be biochemical, or the labeling would also lead to collapse of this very hydrated polymer matrix. Okay? Now, fortunately, right around the time that I started to get interested in this, people started developing ways to label the cell coat on living cells using GFP fusion proteins. This looks beautiful on my screen. It doesn't look very good here. Maybe if we turn out the lights, it's okay. So using GFP fusion proteins, there's a protein that binds to one of the main components in the cell coat, which is a long polymer called hyaluronan, sometimes hyaluronic acid, okay? And so what you can sort of see here are those same cells now with the cell coat labeled, and you can see that there really is something there. So the green is the polymer in the cell coat. So the width of green that you see there is where there's a polymer matrix, and I'll give you the details of what that is in a minute, okay? Before we sort of get into this, you're probably wondering, where is this? Well, this is a fibroblast that's been taken from the forearm of a person. So this is a primary fibroblast put onto the surface, and then it's really hard to see it here, but this is a particle exclusion assay. That's what these are called when you add the red blood cells, and there's a gap between the surface and the particle exclusion assay. So here it's probably easier to see that this is the edge of the cell, and there's a very large open gap. Where the particles don't go. So in a variety of different types of cells, thank you, the cell coat is present, okay? And so what is it exactly? In the cells that I'm interested in for the most part, the backbone of the cell coat that holds the whole thing together is a molecule called hyaluronan, okay? Or in some contexts called hyaluronic acid. Those two words are used interchangeably. Hyaluronan in the cell coat is a very long polymeric polysaccharide, okay, which is extruded by an enzyme called hyaluronan synthase at the surface. It's built disaccharide by disaccharide by an enzyme called hyaluronan synthase, and it's sort of squirted out like hair would be from your head, okay? The hyaluronan synthase can maintain it and keep it attached to the surface, but it also interacts with other membrane receptors, plasma membrane receptors, like CD44, which bind it to the surface, okay? And there have been experiments that have shown that if you strip a cell of its cell coat, and then you fix the cell, you can maintain the presence of these CD44 proteins and put hyaluronan back in and reconstitute the cell coat, where the cell has been turned off because it's been fixed, it's dead, right? When you do that, and then you do a particle exclusion assay, you don't see the sort of big extent that you would see. Hyaluronan is a big hydrophilic molecule, but it's not so space-filling that it's going to give you these sort of micron distances that we're looking at. So the other key component of a paracellular coat are hyaluronan binding proteins, many of which look something like this. So this is a thread of hyaluronan, and on the side here we have something called a proteoglycan, which consists of a protein core with lots of little polysaccharide side chains, glycosaminoglycans that are charged, What we're looking at in particular here is something called agrecin. For those of you who know a little bit about cartilage and chondrocytes, agrecin is basically the primary component of the cell coat. And so when agrecin binds to hyaluron and it stretches it out and gives it a much longer persistence length, and so in these experiments where they add the hyaluron in and they reconstitute a matrix, they don't see anything, but if they add agrecin, the whole coat swells and you have something present on the surface. So it's important to have a combination of a long hyaluronan thread bound to the surface and then also some kind of proteoglycan. And there's a family of proteoglycans like agrecin, they all look similar probably to from a physicist's point of view, called versicin, neuricin, there's one other one, that are present in smooth muscle cells, in fibroblasts and so forth, and on neurons, okay? So hyaluronan is a thread that ties all of it together, but most of the mechanical properties and the different properties that we're interested in are really governed by this agrecin molecule. Let me tell you one other thing. The size of this molecule is huge. It's about 400 nanometers long, and it's about 80 nanometers wide. Okay, so it really takes up a hunk of space, and it really forces the hyaluronan to stretch out, so that's how it works. Hyaluronan, on the other hand, is got a relatively short persistence length when it's on its own. Okay, so why does the pericellular coat matter? Well, in chondrocytes or cartilage cells, which are the cells that we've been playing around with to just get our feet wet and work with a coat that's relatively thick, it's well known that they help protect the cells and they help protect your joints and your cartilage, okay? So mechanical protection is certainly something that matters. But in the context of your skin and your tissue and the other cells that I've shown you, if you do have this thick cell coat, then of course you're going to have some kind of a very heterogeneous matrix that molecules have to diffuse through to get from whatever is in the extracellular matrix down onto the cell surface. And so there's a question of diffusion through this and transport through this cell coat that matters. And then more recently, I've realized that there's a lot of interest or suspicion that these proteoglycans that are bound to the hyaluronan act as binding sites for growth factors and other chemical signals that the cells may use at certain points in time. And so it may also be a sort of chemical reservoir, okay? So the thing that really caught my interest, though, is that the presence or absence of the cell coat or the modulation of the cell coat and also its organization is directly related to events that involve some kind of adhesion event, okay? So cell proliferation, when a cell divides, it comes up from the surface, it isolates itself from the surrounding extracellular matrix, it doesn't want to be very sticky. Well, during that time, it's been shown that hyaluronan expression goes up, that the cell coat becomes thicker, that's needed. If you suppress it, even if you don't have any sort of surrounding extracellular matrix for the cells to get stuck to, proliferation goes down, okay? Another event that requires a sort of intimate regulation of the cell's adhesion to the substrate or its surroundings is cell migration, okay? And in cell migration, what you see with pericellular coats is you have an asymmetric matrix where you have much more in the back and less in the front, in the leading edge, sort of as you would expect, related to where you have lots of focal adhesions and fewer focal adhesions or weaker and stronger focal adhesions. It would be this way, okay? And so its relation to modulation of adhesion and how it dances in this sort of already intricate dance with integrin attachment and focal contact formation is completely unclear, but clearly there's something going on there. And then the final thing that's really interesting about this from my point of view is that it's just begging to be something which is doing some kind of mechanotransduction. It's got all of the circuitry there in place. I'm not sure if I pointed it out, but if you look at the CD44 receptor, if you look at the CD44 receptor here in the plasma membrane, the main thing that the hyaluronan binds to, you have it bound here, and on the other side, it has ways to interact with the actin. So something interesting should be going on there, but there's very little evidence for it, and the only place where it's been looked for is in the context of chondrocytes, and even there, it's sort of sketchy. Okay, so I hope I've convinced you that this is sort of interesting, obviously, there's sort of lots of physical questions that one can ask about that are related to the things that I've pointed out. Okay, so how do we go about exploring this? Really, what we're trying to do is develop a toolbox right now to address the sort of broader questions that I've pointed out, and we're just trying to understand how to go about doing this best. So I'll tell you, if I have time, about two different assays that we do. okay? One of them is a cell coat assay with an optical trap. Basically, what we do is we take quite large beads. We take 3-micron beads, and to give you a sense of scale, the cells that we're working with have a cell coat. When you perform a particle exclusion assay, that's about 7 microns or so. Okay, so these are pretty big, okay? So we take 3-micron beads. They need to be very, very well passivated so they don't interact with the aggrecan and the hyaluronan. We move them into the cell coat at some speed. Usually it's about 8 microns per second. When we get about 3 microns away, we stop. And we stop because the cell itself has little microvilli on its surface, and we don't want to bump into them or somehow attach to them in any way, get plasma membrane tethers and things like that. When we get inside, we stop and we wait for about 5 to 10 seconds, depending on what we're doing, primarily because the dynamic force curve that you get when you're moving peaks, and then it relaxes, okay? And it goes to some non-zero value. And then after that time, we back out and we retract and measure the force as we go out, okay? So let me show you what that data looks like. These force curves are pretty interesting. This is a full force curve. Most of the details about what the cell coat is doing is in the part that you can hardly see here. This is going through the coat, this is relaxation, this is going out of the coat, and then this is us waiting on the outside and relaxing. Now, if we probe it multiple times in a row, you'll see I can overlap these curves for you. We basically get the same curve over and over and over again. There's a little bit of change, but there's not any sort of response on the time scale that we're working. So, looking for some kind of mechanotransduction or cell response, cell doesn't seem to be very sensitive to what we're doing here, at least. Okay. So if you look at the forces you're moving in, and you overlap all of those force curves that I just showed you, they usually look something like that. Like it's very nice. We're not somehow destroying the matrix. We're not tearing it apart. It seems to heal from whatever damage, if we're doing any, as we push into it. Okay. I'm sorry. So this is versus time, and then this is kind of awkward. What happens is my grad student plots it depending on whether it's on the left or the right of the cell. And so this is going towards the cell surface, and we always stop at 3 microns. So this is 3 microns away from the cell, and then this is getting further and further away. Zero is at the surface. Yeah, sorry about that. That's a good question. Yeah, that's right. So the forces and these units will sometimes flip sign just because it has to do with what side you're on. And I should comment, basically the cells, if you saw them, are sort of elongated, and there's always one side of them that's quite flat. And so we go out of our way to look for that type of phenotype of cell, and we always push in perfectly perpendicular to the cell surface so that we hope that we're measuring something similar as we go along. Okay. So if you go ahead and look and see how the scales on a power law, we actually see that it has maybe a minus 2.2. If you look at all of the different curves and you fit them and average them, you still get this. If you average all of them and fit it, you get this. I'm not sure if something is going on here, but we'll come back to this a little bit in the end, okay? Now, this point where we're at the surface of the cell, or close to the surface of the cell, but not touching, where we let things relax, the force decays, but you notice that it doesn't go to zero. We have some non-zero equilibrium, okay? And we can look, you can also look at the time scale of the decay you have here. We've tried to see, is it exponential? Is it a double exponential? It usually takes 1 or 2 seconds, but it doesn't have any sort of simple scaling, no matter what you do to it. But we definitely always have something which is non-zero, and this is most likely due to osmotic pressure in the cell, cell coat, and possibly due to some cell substrate bead interactions, as you'll see in a moment. So it's possible to go in and actually look at this equilibrium force as a function of distance as you move towards the cell surface. For various technical reasons, we don't just move in equilibrium and measure it as we go and get a smooth curve. We move in, we sit somewhere, we wait for it to decay, and then we go out. Okay, and that's why this has dots here instead of just a smooth curve. We should be able to do that, but we haven't gotten that capability yet. So these are what I would call equilibrium force curves. This is what the force is in the cell coat as a function of distance as you move through it. And this is, we're starting to fill in the dots, and we see a lot more structure. Usually, this is what most of our data looks at this point. And there's sort of two things that we see. In the dynamic force curves, I didn't point it out, but you can usually detect something maybe about 10 microns away from the cell surface. which is further than anything that you see with the GFP labeling or with the particle exclusion assay. Shouldn't be too surprising because you're compressing it. But here, you can't really see anything. Within our resolution, there's no force that's detectable out beyond about 6 microns, which is around the place where the red blood cells stop, okay? And usually the equilibrium peak at the cell surface varies a little bit, but the maximum is 10 piconewtons or so. All right, and then there's moving out. If you go ahead and look at that, it looks similar. If you compare moving in and moving out, you see a difference, okay? Shouldn't be too surprising, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but you also see something else here. You see that this moving out curve, so I guess I should be careful. So you move out, and you put everything on top of each other, so now we're going back away from the cell surface, right? So you see the force decay, but it actually becomes negative at some point, okay? So depending on what's going on in our system, sometimes we can get very negative forces. This is now the same sort of data that we looked at before, where the blue curve here is pushing in, you see the force increase. So that would be the same as this blue curve right here. And then you come out, and this is the coming out, but you see we get very, very negative forces, right? So this is some sort of not well-defined interaction between the bead and the matrix, possibly entanglement, possibly adsorption. If we wait long enough, and here in this experiment we did not wait long enough, but if you wait long enough, the force actually eventually relaxes to zero. And so you can go back in with the same initial conditions, presumably, that you had before. If you don't wait long enough, and I think this is sort of interesting to notice, as you move back in and you get to the point around the place where the cell coat would normally be probed by a particle exclusion assay, the forces overlap. Okay, so whatever kind of interactions that we have going on between the bead and the matrix is relatively small in the inner region of the cell coat where we're interested in looking at the structure. Okay. All right, so just very crudely doing first order approximation, thinking about what the forces are on the beads and why we have the differences in these curves and so forth, you can say, well, when you're moving in, you're going to have some elastic osmotic force on the bead from the polymer matrix. You'll have some viscous force, okay? When you're moving out, the elastic force is still in the same way, but you're moving in the opposite direction, and so the viscous force is reversed. And so you can look, or you can sort of approximate what moving in and moving out would be. Okay, and actually Michael Rubenstein pointed out something that's kind of obvious but also really useful, and I didn't see it at first, which is that if you add the two of these together and you don't have any major interaction terms and you just look at the symmetric part of this, right, then the sum of the two divided by two should be equal to the elastic force, okay? Where the elastic force, again, if you don't have any tethering, would just be this equilibrium force we've been measuring. So that's nice because we have two different ways to get data. Two different sets, sort of different approaches to collecting data, and you can compare the two. And this is a pretty typical curve for what you see. So this is the F plus curve, right? So this is Fn plus F out divided by 2. This is the equilibrium data where we have a little bit more of it sketching out. And you see that they, I don't know, I wasn't very satisfied when I looked at this, but they're sort of close, okay? And actually there's a couple of features here that are really reproducible. Went backwards. So usually the equilibrium curve is slightly shifted above, okay? It always passes through a point where it's actually equal to the curve, and then it becomes less than whatever it is, okay? So at the special point X star, that's actually a place where equilibrium actually does equal F plus, okay? Now, if you go and you look at this for lots of different cells and lots of different data, it's pretty reproducible. They're not very pretty, but you always have this trend that the equilibrium is similar or greater than the F plus. It crosses over, and there's not much space here, right? We're probing a really short territory, but it crosses over, and then it crosses underneath this first. So looking at this, a simple way to interpret this is to say, okay, well, what's going on, not surprisingly given some of these negative forces that we're getting, is that we have another additional term, or several additional terms that we're putting all together in here, that basically depends on where you are with respect to this X star. It's sort of a restoring force, which, if you're on the left of it, is going to be pulling you back this way, and if you're on the right of it, it's going to be pulling you back that way, okay? And that would explain how you go under and over here. And we're still sort of working out the details of this, but it seems promising. All right, so another question that I spent a lot of time wondering about, and I think I have enough evidence to answer it now, is when you push something into the cell coat, okay, is it like laying your head down in a pillow and having the whole pillow to form around your head and you just compress it? Okay, is that what I'm measuring? Or am I sort of pushing through it and, you know, interacting with all those aggregate molecules and sort of penetrating into it, okay, going into a jungle of some kind? And so an experiment that we recently did was we basically went in with one bead, okay, and then followed behind it with a second bead to see what was there, to see if we maybe can carve a tunnel in the cell coat or somehow reduce the forces that you have, okay? The assay was a little bit different, actually. So what we do is we move in, but again, because of how narrow it is and because we have all of this experience with 3-micron beads, we wanted to keep working with them. And so what we did was we actually shifted one a tiny bit over so we could move the other one as much as possible, so the forces were as large as possible. And the way we did this, for just as a technical note for people who work with optical tweezers, was using translating holographic optical tweezers. And using holographic optical tweezers to make force measurements is like a whole business in and of itself, actually, right? But it's possible to do it, but the curves that I'm going to show you are actually equilibrium curves. What's interesting about translating holographic tweezers is you can't measure viscous force, which can be something that's useful. I could never get one of those dynamic force curves. And so what you're looking at is first the red is the first one going in, and the blue is the second one going in, okay? And so what you see is that the forces are still very similar, and maybe even a little bit more because the material has been pushed out, but it would suggest that, in fact, you are sort of going into the jungle and you're not just deforming this, and that the matrix isn't cross-linked, right, that you can penetrate into it. Okay, so another game that you can play is modifying the cell coat, okay? There's a lot of games you can play, and we're sort of at the tip of an iceberg here, but it's fun to modify the cell coat and see how these force curves change. And so one of the things that we've tried to do is work with the cells to downregulate the expression of aggrecan or upregulate the expression of aggrecan. And we're working with a biologist to do that. But in the meantime, we did the obvious thing, dump aggrecan into them and see what happened. Here, this is sort of a normal cell, just a control cell. And if you measure lots of them and you always measure them at the same place, which is right here, okay, sort of right in the side where it's straight, and you measure from it, you get something of about 7 microns, plus or minus one or so. When you treat the cells with the aggrecan and you incubate it for 2 hours, the cell coat basically doubles or almost triples. Okay, so you see it swelling out, and it's actually fantastic. So if you do this at different aggrecan, you see something that looks like a nice binding curve where you see the thickness of the cell coat, and this is over 100 of cells, grows as you increase the aggrecan concentration that you have in the solution. And so this sort of brings forward the most simple and obvious is that you have hyaluronan already on the cell surface, aggrecan, and by adding more in, you're stretching it out, okay? That's the simpleton physicist's explanation. We're in the middle of doing the controls to demonstrate that the cell isn't reacting to the aggrecan and possibly producing more hyaluronan or making longer hyaluronan or whatever would be happening. But in the meantime, you can pick these cells and you can go in with an optical trap and you can go ahead and see how the forces have changed and see what's different. And so these are force curves in a swollen aggrecan coat. We're a little puzzled by this, I guess. So you see that the force as you're moving in sort of becomes a little bit negative, which would mean that we have a little bit of tethering behind us. Do you see what I mean? Because this is a force curve moving in. It should be definitely at zero or above zero here. But you do begin to feel force much further out, okay? And then the peak force is 2 or 3 times larger than what we normally would have. And the equilibrium force is also on the order of larger than this. But this is all very preliminary data, okay? But that gives you a taste of the kinds of things you can do. And if you look at the scaling of the aggrecan, remember I showed you that this was minus 2.2. I can't tell you why. I can't tell you why this is either. That's why I'm here. But you can see that things have changed, and you actually have sort of two very clean regimes. Okay. So this is one way that we go about trying to understand the structure and mechanics of the cell coat. Briefly, I'll also just summarize another thing that we've gone about doing, which is to use particle tracking, microrheology. Okay? So as you know, as most of you probably know, you can look at the diffusion of spheres and viscoelastic solutions, okay? It's a tricky business, but you can do it, and you can back out how their motion is related to the mechanics locally or the structure locally. And so what we did, or what Heike Bohm did, actually, she was a graduate student that I worked closely with when I was a postdoc, and then also when I came to the US. She sprinkled beads in around these cells, okay, let them diffuse, worked with a very, very fast camera, and looked at their motion, okay? And then what she tried to do was bin their typical MSD as a function of distance to the cell surface. And she found in general, and this was just what came out of it, that in order to get the kinds of statistics we needed to come up with anything interesting with these experiments, it was really tricky and the data looked really messy, especially since different cells have different thicknesses of cell coats. Because what we would always do is label the cell surface, sprinkle in the beads, make lots of measurements, analyze the data, and then when we were done, do a particle exclusion assay to find the thickness, okay? Because that matters, because you want to know sort of, am I comparing data between similar cell coats, okay? Because there is some variation in these. And in the end, what she found, and we don't really understand that, is that if you take the perpendicular distance of the sort of average position of one of these beads and divide it by the distance found by the particle exclusion assay and plot the MSD versus that coordinate, the data actually looks nice, okay? And so what we did was we would do these kinds of experiments, and then we binned up the data into different average distances away from the cell coat. So these bins are pretty big, but it is spatially resolved microrheology. And if you do that, what we found is that the mean squared displacement as a function of distance from the cell coat decreases as you might expect it to. It should move more slowly as it gets closer to the cell surface. So this top curve is red, and it's outside of the cell coat, which is defined as the basically P equals 1, perpendicular distance divided by cell coat thickness. And then if you look at the different regimes, 0.7 to 1, okay, that's getting closer, and this way it's getting closer, the MSD decreases, okay, at any given tau, okay, and it also changes slope. So if you pick... No, this is just a pretty picture. This is just art. So this is a red blood cell. I mean, sorry, this is a chondrocyte cell that we measure. And this is its cell coat. And these are the red blood cells, and this is just sort of, there's no beads in this picture. The beads were in the last picture. Yeah. No, and we don't, of course, we don't make these measurements when the red blood cells are there, because it would be a mess. Yeah, okay. So looking at some specific tau, you can look and see how the mean squared displacement changes as a function of distance into the cell coat. It's noisy. This is not a statistical ensemble. This is just looking at each of the beads and what they were doing and plotting it. And so you see a trend that when you're greater than 1, when you're sort of outside of the cell coat, you have what you would expect in solution, and then the mean squared displacement decreases very noisily, but approximately linear towards the cell coat. And if you look at the diffusive exponent, you also see that it decreases towards the cell coat, where 1 would mean you have something that's purely viscous, 0 would mean you have something perfectly elastic, and we have something that goes as, basically, it's at 0, it's 0.5, okay? So I think the last thing I want to show you is something which has a lot of assumptions in it, and it may or may not be the right way to do this. It depends on what is going on with the beads in the cell coat itself. But if you can make the assumption that these beads, which are 450 nanometers in diameter, are larger than the mesh size in every place that you're measuring them, and you make the assumption that they're not sticking to the cell coat, which I'm actually quite concerned about at this point, seeing my optical tweezer data, okay, then you can play a game where you can relate the modulus to the MSD, okay, and you can also relate it to the concentration. And the reason why I wanted to do this was because I wanted to address something that a lot of physicists were interested in originally, which is the statement that the cell coat is a polymer brush. And we know how concentration should scale as a function of distance away from the cell surface, and we have different theories that would predict that. So if I make these assumptions and I take my mean squared displacement data and I relate it to concentration, okay, or assume that 1 over MSD is the concentration, and I look at the slope, I get a slope of minus 0.4, okay? So it's interesting, if you believe the data, if you believe that we're really, this is an appropriate approach, and you believe that the particles are not sticking to the cell coat, at least we have clear evidence that it's neither of these two models, right? Okay, so I think I'm at the end of my talk. For the particle tracking microrheology, we found that scaling with relative position worked really well with our data, and it suggests that the polymer layer is somehow cell-similar. Look, comparison with the models is not that it's not an engrafted polymer brush. If you want to believe the data, you could say the viscosity increases by a factor of 2, the elasticity by a factor of 10. Eventually, this has to come full circle and match up with our optical tweezer data, and it doesn't, so we have to work this out. So conclusions and outlook. We're really in the place now where we're beginning to feel confident about the tools we have for probing the paracellular coat. We're doing sort of the last set of obvious experiments right now. We have preliminary data looking at how these force curves vary with bead size and with speed. We need to work closely with Michael, who's recently started helping with these experiments, to back out as much information as we can about the ultrastructure. And in the longer term, I think really the biological question that I have in mind, and that, you know, I'm not just fooling around and making measurements and trying to apply polymer theory, but really look at the biological questions, is to understand what the regulation is between the expression of the cell coat and attachment to the surface, okay? Because I think that there's something really interesting going on there. And secondly, to look into the possibility that mechanotransduction exists through the paracellular coat. This work, of course, wasn't done by me. It was done by students that I'm working with. Lewis McLean is a grad student in my lab. He did all of the optical tweezer experiments. Heike Bohm was someone I was really fortunate to work with when I was a postdoc in Germany in the group of Joachim Spatz. This work initially started there, and then she started working with me. All of the particle tracking microrheology work is hers. And I just wanted to point out Jan Scrimgeour, who's a postdoc in my lab, and he, you know, he's a postdoc, he does everything, and he's helped Lewis a lot with the holographic optical tweezer experiments, the GFP expression, and so forth. And I'd also like to thank Michael for teaching me polymer physics. So, thanks.
Thank you.
What is known about charges of major players? These polysaccharides, protein, your beads.
Yeah, so.
Is anybody strongly charged?
So the, the proteoglycan is very strongly charged. The hyaluronan is charged. It has a pKa of 4, and so at pH 7, it's all the carboxyl groups are.
Same charge?
Yes, it's all very negative.
All very negative?
Yes, it's all very negative. And then the beads themselves are coated with PEG, and my understanding is that sort of screens the charge or sterically inhibits any kind of charge interaction. Because our goal is to prevent any kind of interactions with the beads. So.
Mm-hmm. No one took this microphone away from me last time, so can I jump in? This was lovely. Just two quick questions for clarification. Firstly, the very last thing you said, I wasn't sure how you could claim that the bead displacement data immediately, if you did either of those two brush theories, mm-hmm. They were talking about local concentration. To relate mm-hmm. that to the local viscosity and diffusion is quite a different matter and requires more theory. Mm-hmm. So you've obviously either hidden something under the carpet or.
So I did something very simple, and it may be incorrect. What I did was I just sort of out of a textbook said, okay, I should be able to relate G to the concentration, and I should be able to relate it to 1 over MSD. And therefore, I can relate 1 over MSD to the concentration, and this is basically the polymer fraction. And so
I think this is a discussion over backboard with Michael and some others actually over coffee. I don't think
yeah,
that's
Michael wasn't involved in this, just
okay.
to let you know.
No, it's a lot more subtle than that because of orient. It's a highly oriented medium. All sorts of things. It's not,
okay.
So second thing was very much simpler. Mm-hmm. Your F plus and F minus, mm-hmm. The F minus bit, which you didn't talk so much about, mm-hmm. which is the viscoelastic bit, should be rate dependent. And I didn't know whether we saw any rate dependent data. Have you looked at different
right.
rates?
So we're still sorting through all of it. So with the F minus, it should be the viscoelastic part if you get it correct, but you have to correct for it with all of the entanglement or the interaction terms that you find from F plus.
Oh, I'm just talking about data.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure you do. But.
Yeah. I mean, so we do have preliminary data that shows that if you go at different speeds that you get different forces. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It doesn't scale with, so far it doesn't scale with velocity as you would expect. So Stokes drag. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hello, Jennifer. I have a question regarding the experiment where. Hello, I'm here.
Oh, hi.
If I would do it near a vesicle, a passive membrane bilayer vesicle, then I would deform the vesicle, and the membrane would, you know, before you have relaxed completely the stress, you deform it because of the interaction through the matrix. And so the question, do you know really where the surface is, or where you point the zero is where the surface was?
Yeah, so I think that there are effects that could be going on there, but I think that they're smaller than other effects. So we've done the controls where we eat away the hyaluronan coat with hyaluronidase, and then we go in and we look and see what happens, and we don't see anything on the scale that we do in these experiments, if that makes sense. So controls show that we can, I was always worried about hydrodynamic coupling and how that affects things, But I guess the cell is pretty rigid, and we also try, I mean, we stay 3 microns away from the cell surface purposely to try and minimize effects like that, but surely they're important as well. But I think they don't dominate what we measure.
Have you ever tried to purposely make the beads interact by making them cationic?
Yeah.
Presumably this is like when you want to transfect the cell, you're adding these cationic particles. Are they able to cross-link this glycocalyx?
I haven't tried to just cross-link it using positively charged spheres. I have been able to cross-link beads to the coat using beads coated with a hyaluronan binding protein. We haven't. Yeah, there's just too many things to do, so we haven't gone in that direction.
Jennifer, here. Mm-hmm. I was confused by your two-bead experiment. Mm-hmm. When the first bead is being brought in, I can understand the DC force, you know, sort of a relaxed force by interaction with the cell. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of some cushion that you compress. But the second bead, how can that have a DC force? I mean, I could just imagine that measuring in elasticity, but it should sort of have a different restoring force against the cell if the other bead, you know, is already carrying the load. How do you envision that?
So the way I envision it is that the coat has rearranged around the bead and it's let it in and made space for it, and most of it has come back, or that it's really three-dimensional and you have so much material on the sides that it basically comes in and resists the bead. But that there's not a hole that's carved in for this, a tunnel for the second bead to follow in and feel no force whatsoever.
But you move them at the same time, right?
No, I don't move them at the same time. I move them separately. Yeah, I move them separately. So what I do is I move the first one in, and I actually move it to the side a little bit, which makes it less than perfect. And then I follow in with the second bead, right? So the only thing I would worry about is that by moving it to the side, I'm letting things come back. But if I left it there, then, you know, then maybe it wouldn't be such a big effect. Yeah, I mean, there's other experiments with Erin Rarica, who's moving, she's using optical tweezers to drive beads through actin networks, and she sees that there's a hole left in the actin, right? So it would be possible.
I have two simple questions. One, you may have mentioned it. Do you see anisotropy in the MSDs relative to the surface? I mean, if this is an aligned polymer brush, would we expect anisotropy?
So that you see more in one way than the other way. Yeah. I tried to get Heike to look at that, but she just never did it. Or she didn't see it. I don't know.
And then the other thing, you alluded to this at the very beginning. You said you were really excited about how the coat is upregulated or expression increases during division. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that? Have you looked at, say, division rates or how two cells move apart in repulsion, you know, et cetera?
Right. Yeah, so I see I've captured your imagination as well. So I haven't done that because I sort of want to bring something new to the table before I do any of that. But biologists haven't really done it either. You know, it's really that's not out there. And even being able to label the coat with GFP and look at it while it divides is new. So there is a lot of interesting things that can be done there. But what people have shown is that if you somehow turn off hyaluronan synthase, or if you use hyaluronidase to cut away the hyaluronan and eliminate the cell coat, you really downregulate proliferation. And it really interferes with the process. But the thing that concerns me, and I think this is always the question that biophysicists have, is it chemical or is it mechanical, physical, right?
Because it.
Yeah, but then, yeah, and then you have to do all of, yeah, you could, and you have to do all of the controls to see what the cells do in the presence of that, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's really the question, is there a physical role? The biological literature is full of comments about lubrication by hyaluronic coats and mechanics of hyaluronic coats and that it's important, but nobody sort of really puts their finger on it or even looks under the surface at all. So that's, you know, that's what we're trying to do.
I actually also have a quick question. It is related to the question that was just asked. So how dynamic is the whole coat? Do we imagine it as a system which is continuously replenished and shed off, or is it?
That's a great question.
Once produced, is it stable and remains?
That's a great question. So hyaluronic turnover in the body is really fast.
So if you shaved off the cell, it would really.
Yeah. So I've tried to do those experiments. So I've done the first. I have this. In my first slide, I have this picture of cells with like lots of tweezers around it. I've tried that experiment where I shave off the coat and then I put optical tweezers in an array around it and I wait for it to grow back and I want to see the forces. And I haven't been able to measure it. Like the cells always die before I get to that point. But if you just do it, if you do it where you take the cells and put them in the incubator and then you take them out every half an hour and you do a particle exclusion assay or optical tweezer experiment, then you can measure something and you can see that the cell coat replenishes itself in 3 hours. 3 to 6 hours, it depends. So, but I also think that there is a lot of turnover in the hyaluronin as well.
Mm-hmm. When you add the aggregatin, do you see morphological changes in the cells? We've been seeing filopodia coming out of the cells like crazy when we do that.
Ah, yes, okay, so, yeah, so we saw that once. And it was really interesting. And you might, if you're working on this, and you must know about the filopodia cells that the Finnish group always studies, right? So there's this sort of beautiful effect, and I think it's dying for a biophysicist to address it because it looks like an instability to me, where you have if you overexpress hyaluronin production with hyaluronin synthase, often the cells will somehow start growing these tremendously long filopodia filled with actin. And they go out like 20 microns from the cell surface. And then there's hyaluronin on the sides of these filopodia. I've seen it once, but I actually made Lewis go and look thoroughly to make sure that those were not there, because that would just make our experiments totally different and very difficult. So, yeah. But I think that Heike has seen that as well in things that she's followed up with. So it happens sometimes.
Okay, one more quick question, if I may. The many, many cells with substantial glycocalyxes are exposed to shear flow.
Mm-hmm.
How do you imagine this would affect the properties of the coat, the permeability or the mechanical properties? Because the shape of the
So those are probably endothelial cells, right, mm-hmm. that are exposed. And the glycocalyx of endothelial cells is quite a different beast, as I understand it, than what I'm looking at. So I don't know enough about the structure, but I would assume that you would have some, if there was any entanglement, that maybe it would become unentangled and everything would become more aligned. But I don't know about the components enough.
Okay, one more question.
Quick question. You might guess that as the osmotic pressure becomes large in the glycocalyx, that it puts these, if they are grafted in some way, it puts the cell wall under tension.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried to see whether you could correlate can you measure the tension of the wall and the relation between the tension and the density of the glycocalyx?
I would have to like shave half of the cell, and if I could measure tension on the other side, if I could do that and have half cell coat and half no cell coat, yeah. And then go on the other side with another trap and pull,
mm-hmm.
I could.
Okay.
Do you think that, I guess, presumably the idea is that it would propagate through
Your experiment suggests that there might be a connection between cell shape and mm-hmm. the osmotic pressure in the mm-hmm. glycocalyx.
Right. Yeah, that's another thing that we're sort of gearing up to do is to look and see how micropatterning the cells on the surfaces changes the expression of the glycocalyx. So the inverse of that.
Okay, let's thank Jennifer again.